The longing for the reality of God. Now, there's quite a bit to cover this evening, and I'm not going to get to the first six verses of chapter 42. That's the last chapter of Job. We'll deal with all of chapter 42 next week, but we will go to the end of 41. The longing for the reality of God. As Matthew Arnold said, with aching hands and bleeding feet, we dig and heap, lay stone on stone. We bear the burden and the heat of the long day and wish 'twere done. Not till the hours of light return, all we have built do we discern. And now the hours of light are coming to Job. And he's about to see what he has been building for God through these, what I believe, are years of agony and silence. We're reading then in the 30th chapter of the book of Job. And again, I'm reverting to the King James Version for this particular evening. When the printers were given this little study sheet to print, the printer, who is a member of this Bible class, he was telling me tonight, just when they were collected, he said the boys who did the typesetting, they wanted to know how the fight went. And, of course, my friend said, what fight? Oh, they said the fight is between Job and God. And my friend couldn't understand until he read the first point that you have on your study sheet tonight. The first round between God and Job. And these fellows couldn't understand. They said, God and Job having a fight. Well, it's a first round of speeches. And then there is a second round of speeches between the pair of them, and we hope to deal with both during this study this evening. Now let's take it very gently, but very systematically, as we go down it verse by verse. The Lord helping us. Here is the answer. And please, don't walk out before the end of the answer. Because some people have got very irritated at God's answer. And they say, is that all there is to it? After all that, just be patient and you shall see more than you realize before we're finished. Verses 1 to 3 of chapter 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man. Stand up like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Now, what do we learn from these three verses? Well, first of all, when God at last speaks, Job is rebuked, as your notes have it, but he's not derided. You remember that way back at the beginning of the story, Job's troubles began when a great wind killed his children. And the Lord was in that storm. And now he speaks again through a storm. Job is first rebuked, but certainly not derided, for speaking without knowledge. Will you please notice that the Bible does not consider ignorance to be a sin, or even the root of sin? As a friend used to say to me, I think it was, or did I read it somewhere, it's not a shame to be ignorant, but it's a shame to remain so. Ignorance is not a sin. And God says, now look, Job, you have been darkening counsel without knowledge. You have been ignorant of a lot of things. All the facts that you know, Job, are not all the facts. And Job, God says in these three verses, was in the dark because he lacked certain knowledge. But God is about to supply that knowledge and fill up his lack. The Lord begins here to, after asking Job to, now stand up before me and I'm going to make some demands of you, Job. The Lord begins to ask Job a whole lot of questions about this world and about his world. You say, well, hey, just a minute. We've been nearly 3 months waiting for an answer. And is the only answer going to be in the form of questions? Well, this first speech that we're about to read and study gives a very rapid sketch of 20 creatures by God. Some of them are inanimate, and some of them are living, and they pass in review. And really, they expand our amazement at the range and the complexity of the works of God. It's fantastic. And to suggest that God's governance is obscure, that God's governance over things, you can't really see it, it's too obscure, is nonsense. Because we're going to see that God's governance is very, very detailed. It's not obscure. Let's look at verse 4 to verse 7. Here's the first few questions. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest? Or who hath stretched a line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. You know, the knowledge of the origins of the world are inaccessible to man. Not if you are to believe a little boy who was in my car yesterday. We were all out in our favorite forest with the children, and a little boy was there, and he declared as we were driving home, "Of course, we all come from apes." And I said, "Well, looking at me, you might think that." He said, "Yeah, no, you have no hair," he said. And I thought, better not pursue that any further. But I tried to point out to that little boy, who was so sure we all came from apes, I simply said to him those favorite words of the preacher, "Prove it." And he kind of changed the subject and passed on. Oh, no doubt his teachers had been trying to tell him that indeed we all came from apes, but it hasn't been proved. Any more than I can scientifically prove to you creation. You can't put God in a test tube or God's work in a test tube completely and declare scientifically the origins. I often say to some people when they say their mother, "My mom really loves me," I often say to them, "Prove it." And they say, "What do you mean, prove it? She puts marmalade on my toast in the mornings." I said, "But how do you know that she doesn't put marmalade on your toast in the morning in order that you will put marmalade on her toast when she's an old lady?" And they look at me, "How dare you say such a thing?" I say, "But prove it. Somewhere along the line, you believe that your mother loves you. You put faith that indeed the evidence that you see comes from love. And you have faith in it, but you can't put a test tube in out and say, 'Now look, there's my mother's love.' It's all proved in a formula." A knowledge of the origins of the world are inaccessible to man. And man is the very latest arrival on the scene. Now the result of creation is seen all around us, but not the act or not the agent. And here then, there is a vast mystery, and the Bible views it in many different ways. It's lovely actually when you study the Old Testament to see the different kind of images used of God in his creatorial work. God is cast in the role of a great builder in verse 4 to verse 7. In other places, he's cast in the role of a potter or a weaver. And God is very often described in his creatorial work in the Word of God. Illustrations are drawn from craftsmen, the crafts of men. And here the world is viewed from verse 4 to verse 7 as a vast edifice whose designer and maker is God. And God was not solitary when he started the world. His world was already populated with creatures, divine beings, sons of God. Notice verse 7. The question is asked, were you there, Job, when I laid the foundations of the earth? And were you there, Job, verse 7, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Sons of God are angels of later theology. And they celebrate it with songs and cheering the achievements of God. As I believe that's what that means, when the stars were made, the angels rejoiced rather than a singing star. You may interpret it differently, but that's what I feel it means. And here we have these created beings around God as he flings stars into space at a word and creates the universe, celebrating with singing. Were you there, Job, when all that happened? You say, hey, Derek, what's that got to do with ulcers and boils and bad breath and colitis and dermatitis and hallucinations at night and three friends who've spoken wrong of God against you and screaming questions from your brain and mind, why is this happening to me, Lord? What kind of an answer is this? Wait, hang on. Verse 8 to verse 11. Tell me, Job, says God. It's a lovely chat, this, you know. Beautiful. Job, who shut up the sea with doors when it break forth as if it had issued out of the womb? And when I made the cloud the garment thereof and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and break up for it my decreed place and set bars and doors, and said, that is, to the sea, hitherto shalt thou come and no further, but no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stead. The origin of the sea, from verse 8 to verse 11, is described by a lovely, vivid use of the metaphor of childbirth. The sea is personified as childbirth. Were you there, Job, when the sea was born and issued from the womb of creation? And then from verse 10 to verse 11, the sea is still personified, but here it's not a baby, but a threatening element that must be kept in place. Now, I was brought up by the sea, and I spent my childhood by the sea. And I love the sea. I truly love it. But it could drown me. It's very cruel. It could break my bones and shed my blood and pass over me, and not a spot of me to be seen ever again. Within seconds, covered and gone. Were you there, Job, whenever I did that? And then from verse 12 to verse 15, God speaking. God now begins to describe to Job the miracle of the daily appearance of the day. Hast thou commanded the morning since thy days, and caused the day spring to know his place? That it might take hold of the ends of the earth, that the wicked might be shaken out of it, and it is turned as clay to the seal, and they stand as a garment, and from the wicked their light is withholden, and the high arm shall be broken. The sunrise is, in these verses, 12 to 15, likened to the removal of the dark robes of the night from the world, exposing the wicked who had sheltered in the dark to do their evil deeds. And they're exposed when the day comes up. On verse 14 and 15, the earth takes shape like clay under a seal, and its features stand out like those of a garment, and the wicked are denied the light, and their upraised arm is broken. Tell me, Job, did you command that to come to pass? And just a minute, Job, if I can paraphrase it a little. Verse 16 to 18. There's another realm, Job, that's beyond the reach of man's understanding, and that's the subterranean region. Verses 16 to 18. Tell me, Job, hast thou entered into the springs of the sea? Or hast thou walked in the search of the depth? Have the gates of death, that is, the great deep is likened to death, been opened unto thee? Or hast thou seen the doors of the shadow of death? Hast thou perceived the breadth of the earth? Declare, if thou knowest it all. Well, these Job obviously has never explored. And the Lord almost banteringly invites Job to make a report. Tell me, Job, about it. Write a report on it, if you know all this. There's no interruption from Job. He says nothing. Then verse 19 to verse 21, light and darkness are personified. Where is the way where light dwelleth? And as for darkness, where's the place thereof? Where's darkness's house, if you like? That thou shouldest take it to the bound thereof, and that thou shouldest know the path to the house thereof. Knowest thou it because thou wast then born, or because the number of thy days is great? Are you old enough to be able to go to where light comes from, and where darkness originated? And then verse 22 to verse 23, and I love the King James rendering of this. Tell me, Job, hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow? Or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and of war? I never truly understood that verse until I saw a very famous film made by the Moody Bible Institute in those wonderful series of films they have called Fact and Faith. If you've never seen them, get to see them. They're available here in Northern Ireland. And they have one, and if I remember right, it's called The Treasures of the Snow. And that lovely Christian scientist Mr. Moon takes the slide and puts a snowflake on it, and then puts the microscope on the snowflake. And I remember as a child in a house just outside Portadown at a place called Ballyworkin, sitting around a roaring fire with a whole lot of people as a little boy on a special evening, where the host in that home, who's now with the Lord, showed to us that film. I'll never forget as a little boy having revealed before my eyes to me all the crystals and the formation of crystals within one snowflake. And there are billions upon billions upon billions upon billions of them in any snowstorm. And you and I walk out over the top of them with our wellies. I don't know whether you wear wellies, but I do anyway. In the snow. Every time the snow comes, my little ones come running and they say, "Come on, Dad, let's walk in the deep snow." And it was so deep this year, they nearly disappeared in the field. The twins anyway. And as I see my children going through the snow, I think, if you kids had only the slightest notion the treasures you're tramping on. If I had the slightest notion of the fact that every single snowflake is different in formation, there's not one of them the same. Tell me, Job, have you entered into the treasures of the snow? Or what about the treasures of the hail, which I have reserved against the time of trouble and against the day of battle and war? You know, the Lord thinks about the snow. the way a man thinks about gold. You know, I'm sure that if I said tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock, £10,000 will be set on the crescent steps outside and first come, first served, there might be quite a queue on. But people perhaps never even bother remarking on a little snowflake. God doesn't count gold as treasure. In fact, God thinks so little of it, the tarmac in heaven is made of gold. You say that's going too far. Think about it. Think about it. It's in the Word. John describes heaven as being paved with gold. That's the way he described it as he saw it. Those are the words that he chose. God thinks so little of it, just walk on it. But snow, he counts treasure. Amazing. And here the image is given as if God has stored, you know, snow and hail in his armory, ready for use in wartime. And of course in Joshua and in Judges we read of God using hailstorms to confound armies. Not the first time God's intervened with a storm. And Job has never inspected this arsenal. Still no word from Job. And then I want to talk to you, says God, about the rainstorm. Well, in Ireland, we know a little about that. When I lived in Newcastle, people used to say, you know, what's it going to do? Well, I say, if you see the mountains, it's going to rain. And if you don't see them, it's raining. Well, verse 24 to 27, but what way is the lightning, that is, parted, which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? Or who hath divided a watercourse for the overflowing of waters, or a way for the lightning of thunder, to cause it to rain on the earth where no man is, on the wilderness wherein there is no man? To satisfy the desolate and waste ground, and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth. I was at a funeral today on the South Tyrone Fermanagh border. And just as we were about to move out from that home after the service in the home, it started to bucket out of the heavens. And I thought to myself, Lord, why did you send that rainstorm just at the moment, whenever this service is going out? And you know, we used to go out to have open air meetings at times, and we still do. And when we go out, I remember with a group, we used to go out a lot, nearly three times every day in the summer, when we were younger, and many days ago, as you can imagine. And when we went out, it used to bucket, just as you were ready to start preaching. I remember on two occasions preaching in Shamrock Park Stadium in Portadown. And I remember 2 years running, there were two of us preaching. It was a beautiful day. People all sitting up there, beautiful, lovely, wonderful open airs, weather. And my friend would preach away. And as sure as daylight, when I got up, it bucketed out of the heavens. I said, all right, Lord. And then the next year I went again, and I'm waiting for them to finish, and as sure as daylight, I get up to preach again, starts to rain. Do you ever wonder about that? I used to have an old friend, he was an elder in the assembly which I was involved in, when the Lord called me to Christian work about 10 years ago. And I remember, he's now with the Lord, he used to say, Derek, God's weather is never against God's work. And that's true. Tell me, when would be the right time to send the shower if you were in charge? When would be the right time? Well, there's a funeral on here, or there's a farmer over there. I mean, how would you work it out? There was a little boy out on the edge of Belfast near Carrieduff was asked once by a Sunday school teacher in front of the class in a little hall. And I know about this because I know a person who was involved in it. He was asked, what is it impossible for God to do? And of course, it's impossible for God to lie. But the little fellow put up his hand. What's it impossible for God to do? He said, sir, it is impossible for God to please the farmers. And that's true, and there are a few of them in here tonight. You see, if I was running it, you see, I would have it at certain times, but then what about this verse, to satisfy the desolate and waste ground and to cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth? We don't know everything. Oh, what a mess of it we would make if we were in charge, but we're not. And Job can't understand even the mysteries of a rainstorm and why it comes at the time it does. Verse 28 to 30, the rain and the dew and the ice and the hoar frost. Hath the rain a father, says God? Or hath begotten the drops, or who hath begotten the drops of dew? Out of whose womb came the ice and the hoary frost of heaven? Who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone. That is, they become hard. I think the translation is, that's the ice there. And the face of the deep is frozen. Now, I'm told that the rain and the dew and the ice and the hoar frost were in old myths little gods. Ice, dew, hoar frost, rain were worshipped as little gods with a father and a mother. But not here. And then in verse 30, of course, with the ice coming, but verse 31 to 33, God moves again. He said, Job, what about the constellations of stars? Canst thou bind the sweet influences of Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Or canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season? Or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons? Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven, and canst thou set the dominion thereof in the earth? Do you know anything about stars, Job? Or how the constellations are run? And these are all constellations. Then, verse 34 to verse 38, God talks about clouds. Canst thou lift up thy voice to the clouds, that abundance of waters may cover thee? And canst thou send lightnings, that they may go and say to thee, here we are? Or who hath put wisdom in the inward parts, or who hath given understanding to the heart? Who can number the clouds in wisdom, or who can stay the bottles of heaven? That doesn't mean to say God's got a whole lot of bottles up there, and he pours them out. It's poetic language, and that's important. When we come to a few verses later on, just remember that we're not expected to believe that God has bottles as such, that clouds are bottles. It is a poetic image. When the dust groweth into hardness and the clods cleave fast together. I love that. Isn't that a beautiful description of drought? He's saying to him, look, Job, nobody really understands fully the movements of the clouds. And here now that the survey of selected natural phenomena ends at verse 38. And the rest of the Lord's first speech and most of the second are devoted to living things that are a bit nearer to you and me, that we see more often perhaps. You see, although man was originally placed in charge with the animals and of the world, no man could hunt prey for the lion. Verse 39. Tell me, Job, would you hunt prey for the lion? Or fill the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and abide in the covert to lie in wait? Or who hath provided the raven his food when his young ones cry unto God? They wander for lack of meat. And here the raven's young ones are described as imploring who for food? God for food. Just as a hungry man does in need. And you know, placing these helpless little birds next to the rapacious lion brings out the benevolence of God to all his creatures, whether they be lions, lionesses, or ravens. You say, what's going on here? Just wait. chapter 39. Job, and I love these four verses. I think this is a beautiful description. Beautiful description. Knowest thou the time when the wild goats of the rock bring forth? Or canst thou mark when the hinds do calve? Canst thou number the months that they fulfill? Or knowest thou the time when they bring forth? They bow themselves, they bring forth their young ones, they cast out their sorrows, their young ones are in good liking, they grow up with corn, they go forth and return not unto them. Now, since all the creatures that God talks about are nearly all untamed animals, the one referred to here is the wild mountain goat or the ibex. And the point that is made here in these four verses is simple, but quite marvelous. Here are goats removed from men. Removed from men who supervise the breeding of their flocks. These animals have their young completely unobserved. By and large, they're wild and in the wild. And their young are unsheltered by man. And Job's invited to reflect on the mystery of instinct. You know, we say animals of instinct, but you know, the Bible would more truthfully call instinct a wisdom of divine origin implanted in animals, by which a mother gives birth and the kid quickly learns self-preservation immediately. Beautiful. Here is this wild mountain goat set free from the bounds of man, yet God looks after them. Verse 5 to verse 8, we move on to a second cousin of the ibex, the wild ass. And what does he do? He lives in the land that God gave him. Verse 5 to verse 8. Tell me, Job, who sent out the wild ass free, or who hath loosed the bands of the wild ass, whose house I have made the wilderness, and the barren land his dwellings? He, that is the wild ass, scorneth the multitude of the city, neither regardeth he the crying of the driver. Now don't laugh. There were no cars at that time. And that reminds me of the little boy in the Sunday school class who was asked to draw what he heard, the story of Genesis, and he drew a car with a dot in the front seat, two dots in the back seat. Sunday school teacher said, "What's that?" "Oh, that's God in the front, and that's Adam and Eve in the back." "But I didn't say anything about a car." "Oh, yes, you did, teacher. You said God drove them out of the garden." You got to be very careful when you're using language. And I'm not being disrespectful. Words can change and change in their meaning. This driver, of course, is the herdsman who comes after these animals. And this wild ass does not regard the crying of the driver. You know, I was thinking about this beautiful description that God gives of this wild ass. Isn't it lovely to think that God made him wild? That God gave him his own land to live in, whose house I have made the wilderness. God cares. Even about where the wild ass lives. He has his own life, which is very wide-ranging. The range of the mountains, verse 8, is his pasture. And his place in the purpose of God is not to be explained by the service that he renders man, like his domesticated cousin. He scorns civilization, verse 7, and the poem seems to express almost a kind of envy for his freedom. He scorns the multitude of the city. And the hardship of the rough terrain doesn't annoy him. But this animal hasn't escaped, will you please notice? He's been released. God has set this beast free for going the legitimate claims that he might have on its services. What's God trying to teach Job here? I think you're beginning to get a point here. Just let the Spirit teach you. Verse 9 to verse 12, the wild ox. The unicorn is a word used in the AV, but the unicorn as such was never known. It is the wild ox, a beast in question known as the A-U-R-O-C-H-S. Will the unicorn be willing to, the wild ox be willing to serve thee or abide by thy crib? Canst thou bind the unicorn with his band in the furrow, or will he harrow the valleys after thee? Wilt thou trust him because his strength is great, or wilt thou leave thy labor to him? Wilt thou believe him that he will bring home thy seed and gather it into the barn? Now, I'm told that this animal has been extinct since 1627. And it was an enormous animal and the most powerful of all hoofed beasts, and excelled in size only by the hippopotamus and the elephant. And in the Old Testament, it is a standard symbol of strength, and it's mentioned 9 times in the Old Testament. And it's ludicrous to think that it would spend the night with a more docile cattle in a crib. Verse 9, will the wild ox be willing to serve thee or abide by thy crib? Not at all. In fact, you couldn't even trust him to bring in your harvest. Verse 13 to verse 18, you come from this sublime animal to the most ridiculous of all animals, the ostrich. He sticks his head in the sand. The symbol of me, sometimes I feel. Maybe you act like that too. We're all a bit of an ostrich in us at times, but what a silly bird it is. From verse 13 to verse 18, you have why it is silly. These are incredible verses. Tell me, Job, givest thou the goodly wings unto the peacocks, or wings and feathers unto the ostrich? Now the ostrich leaves her eggs in the earth, and warms them in the dust, and forgetteth that the foot may crush them, or that the wild beast may break them. She is hardened against her young ones, as though they were not hers, and her labor is in vain without fear. Now why is she so silly? Because God hath deprived her of wisdom. Neither hath he imparted to her, that is the ostrich, understanding. What time she lifteth up herself on high, she scorneth the horse and his rider. Oh yes, she can go faster than a horse. Why is the ostrich a silly bird? Because God made it that way. And this comical account given from verse 13 to verse 18 suggests that amid the profusion of creatures that God has made, and most of them to be useful to man, some are there just for God's entertainment and for ours, so that we can smile at the ostrich. Say, that silly bird. Because God made it that way. And you can't argue with me. It's in the book, brother. Right there. You say, that's not the kind of God I thought he was. You think God privately prefers corrugated iron and whitewash? Wee tiny God have you got? Oh, this is a great God. He can do what he likes. He is sovereign. Can create what he likes. And if you see an ostrich in the middle of the M1 laying her egg, you'll say, well, God made her that way. Amazing, isn't it? There is a comical... I'm sure there's a smile here between God and Job. Ah, but when the ostrich takes off and starts to run, I can tell you she'll leave the horse behind. On his rider. Oh yes, she can go faster than a horse. Why is the ostrich a silly bird? Because God made it that way. And this comical account given from verse 13 to verse 18 suggests that amid the profusion of creatures that God has made, and most of them to be useful to man, some are there just for God's entertainment and for ours, so that we can smile at the ostrich. Say, that silly bird. Because God made it that way. And you can't argue with me. It's in the book, brother. Right there. You say, that's not the kind of God I thought he was. You think God privately prefers corrugated iron and whitewash? Wee tiny God have you got? Oh, this is a great God. He can do what he likes. He is sovereign. Can create what he likes. And if you see an ostrich in the middle of the M1 laying her egg, you'll say, well, God made her that way. Amazing, isn't it? There is a comical... I'm sure there's a smile here between God and Job. But when the ostrich takes off and starts to run, I can tell you she'll leave the horse behind. God has made her swift. God made a wee daisy for us to enjoy. He made the ostrich for us to smile at. But he's made a lot more than that. This is one of the most powerful descriptions of the horse in all of literature. Verse 19 to 25. It's a living portrait of the horse. Hast thou given the horse strength? Hast thou closed his neck with thunder, that is the mane? Canst thou make him afraid as a grasshopper, how the horse leaps? The glory of his nostrils is terrible. I know that because the first one I got on threw me off. He pawed in the valley and rejoiceth in his strength. He goeth on to meet the armed men. He mocketh at fear and is not affrighted. Neither turneth he back from the sword, and the quiver rattleth against him, and the glittering spear in the shield. He swalloweth the ground. That is, he moves over it fast. If you've ever been on the back of a horse flat out, there's no greater thrill in life than that. He swalloweth the ground with fierceness and rage. Neither believeth he that it is the sound of the trumpet. He saith among the trumpets, aha, ha. And he smelleth the battle afar off, and the thunder of the captains and the shouting. What's this? Well, let me paraphrase it. His shrill neigh terrifies. He paws violently. He exults mightily. He charges the foe. He laughs at fear. He's never daunted. He never shies at the sword, as the great battles of earth have shown. Beside him quivers rattle, and spear and javelin flash. He shakes with excitement. He swallows the ground. He can't stand still when the trumpet sounds. Tell me, Job, can you make an animal like that? Can you give him strength? Can you control him? Even the one domesticated animal included in the list is not completely under the control of man. Even the best horsemen have been thrown, as Ulster has known so sadly in the past. Now what's happening here? It's intriguing. God's not finished yet. Job, I want to talk to you about the hawk. Verse 26, does the hawk fly by thy wisdom and stretch her wings toward the south? And Job, what about the eagle? Doth the eagle mount up at thy command and make her nest on high? She dwelleth and abideth on the rock, upon the crag of the rock and the strong place. From thence she seeketh the prey, and her eyes behold afar off, and her young ones also suck up blood where the slain are. There she is. Job, the ability of the eagle is God's gift, and its performance is outside of your wishes. And here you've got man's limited mastery of his environment and God's total sovereignty. Now, the conclusion of the Lord's first speech is a repetition of his challenge to Job in the light of all that he's now said. Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproveth God, let him answer it. Job, you asked me to speak, and I have spoken. Well, what are you going to say now? If Job understands any of these creatures better, or these matters better than God, God's willing to listen to him. The question, of course, here in verse 2 of chapter 40 is ironical. But in view of the friendly tone of the speeches, it's not a snide at Job. God is showing his greatness. If you have anything that you want to tell me more about this, then I'll be glad to hear it, Job. And Job speaks. But he didn't talk as much this time. We don't hear so much from Job now. Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am vile." Now, most translations have that as meaning small, light, insignificant in comparison with you. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once have I spoken, but I'll not answer. Yea, twice, but I'll proceed no further. Now, Job hasn't much to say here. In fact, he's nothing to say. But does that mean he's admitting defeat? No. That he's saying, "Now look here, Lord, I was right all the time, and I've been trying to live for you, and I'm now submitting. These fellows are right around me." No. He doesn't retract any of his former statements. So there's no submission in that sense. He is recognizing his own insignificance. He's of small account. "I don't count for anything," he's saying. There's no defiance in it. There's not even a complaint that God still hasn't answered his questions. Say, "Hey, Lord, why don't you answer my questions and come on and answer the things I've been asking you for months and years?" Not a single complaint that God still hasn't answered his questions. Yet Job has yet to learn, or at least he hasn't fully learned yet, that no logical and conclusive answer can be given, even by Jehovah himself, in terms which the intellect of man under its present conditions can grasp. Now let me make this point thoroughly, friends, and gently. There are young people sitting before me tonight and listening to this recording who have asked many questions when we've studied this book. We've been asking God with Job to have the secret of the universe. "Give me the secret of it all, Lord. Let's know what the secret of your government is and why all these things have been happening to me. Why? Put the secret in my hand, Lord. Let me know. Let me grasp it." But we are asking, when we ask that, more than our hand can grasp and more than our intellect can grasp, while we live under these present limitations. Our minds aren't able to receive that full secret, or intellect either. It wouldn't be good for us, even if it were possible, to have, while our natures are so imperfect. And they need the training which only faith and the ventures of a reverent and an affectionate trust can supply. And when once we really know God, as we will know him better, on the other side, we shall, when we see God as he really is, I'm telling you, we shall learn the insolence of the demand that we're so often tempted to make with God. But the key of the whole course and the aim of God's providence should be placed in my little feeble hand. We'll see how insolent we were, wanting to know everything. When we see him. Now please let me say this. Even though Job is now a more subdued man, and he's in a far more subdued frame of mind, it's not enough for him yet. And God speaks again, and there's some more chapters coming. But this time new things are said. There are two more nature poems that are about to follow here. But they're very different in mood and in the things they say to this gentle review that God has given of what he has made. Verse 8. Or verse 6. "Then answered the Lord unto Job out of the whirlwind and said, Gird up your loins now like a man, I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me. Wilt thou disannul my judgment, and wilt thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous? Hast thou an arm like God, or canst thou thunder with a voice like him? Deck thyself now with majesty and excellence, and array thyself with glory and beauty, and cast abroad the rage of thy wrath, and behold every one that is proud, and abase him. Look on every one that is proud, and bring him low, and tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together, bind their faces in secret. Then will I also confess unto thee that thine own right hand can save thee. See, the personal issue from verse 8 to verse 14 between Job and God is now more directly dealt with here. The problem as seen by the friends is whether Job has been forced to put God in the wrong in order to make himself right. And here God is beginning to sort this out with him. And really, from verse 8 to verse 14 is a challenge to any of us who think we can run the universe better than God, if I was running it. You know, I went to have coffee the other day, and I was, you know, the little snatches of conversations you hear from people, and that's all you hear, just hear a word or two. They can be, you know, my mind goes a riot. I just catch a snatch of conversation, and I think about it later. I was walking past and going up into this little tiny restaurant, and I heard this huge man with an RAF mustache saying to another chap, "Now, if I were Admiral Woodward," that's all I heard. And I sat down for my coffee and I thought, if you were Admiral Woodward. Well, some of us sometimes behave in such a way. If I were God, I wouldn't have done it that way. Oh no, these verses are all against those who would take over the management of the universe. You'd have to be as splendid and you'd have to be as majestic as God. And that's what God says to Job. Hey, Job, he says in verse 10, could you deck yourself with majesty and excellence and array yourself with glory and beauty? Of course you couldn't. Are you equal to the task of bringing down the wicked? Here in verse 12, 13. Verses 12 and 13. And quite honestly, this is bringing Job to the end of his quest by convincing him that he must hand the whole matter of his life and his problems completely over to the Lord and trust him and not fret. And please do it without insisting that God should first answer all my questions and give me a formal acquittal. You don't have to have a formal acquittal, and I don't have to answer all your questions, do I, Job, before you hand everything over to me and trust me. Here's a rebuke. A rebuke for all of us. Only God can destroy creatively. And I'm telling you, the God of heaven can bring good out of evil. And you can't, nor I can't. God can. He's able to make everything, good and bad, work together for good. And the reality of God and his goodness lies behind all his justice, even what he does to the wicked. He says, Job, verse 12, look now on everyone that is proud and bring them low and tread down the wicked in their place and hide them in the dust together and bind their faces in secret. No, you couldn't do that, could you, Job? Well, you'd have to do that if you were going to be me. God can bring good out of evil. Please remember that. I don't know how he does it, but he does it. And he can restore the years that the locusts have eaten, things that are wasted. A farmer can't do it, but God can. And even if your life has been wasted, and your life has been wrecked and ruined by sin, God can even bring blessing to your life and restore to you the years the locusts have eaten. Ah, no, I haven't time to go into all the details here. Verse 15 down to verse 24 is a description of a huge animal called Behemoth. And verse 41 is the description of another huge creature called Leviathan. And this is the climax to which the two earlier poems are leading. And we're now enforced by these two poems to face up to two monstrous animals, altogether beyond man's power to tame. Now, Behemoth and Leviathan, are they real or are they mythological? I tell you, a lot of arguments have raged between these two. And I want you to read the details of these two later on. I haven't time to read them at the moment. But verse 15 down to verse 24, cast your eye down now just as I'm talking. Look at the strength of Behemoth in verse 6, his strength is in his loins. Look at his tail, verse 17, like a cedar. Look at his bones, they're like metal. He is the chief of the ways of God. He that made him can take a sword to approach unto him, and surely the mountains bring forth food where all the beasts of the field play. He lieth under shady trees in the covert of the reed and fens, and he's covered by shady trees. Verse 23, he drinketh up a river and hasteth not. He trusteth that he can draw up Jordan into his mouth. He taketh it with his eyes, and his nose pierceth through snares. Now what is it? You say it's an elephant. Well, maybe it is. You say it's a hippopotamus. Maybe it is. Say it's a crocodile. Maybe. It's not defined. But just let me say at this point that the majority of biblical scholars feel that these two animals were actual. And when we get into Leviathan in chapter 41, who is a huge thing in water, the other seems to be more on land. When you get into Leviathan, it's true that very fanciful language is used. He actually breathes fire. And my wife said to me today, he's got to be a dragon, Derek. Well, I don't know. But I can tell you this much, that when I look at him in this tremendous chapter and he's spoken off as breathing fire, doesn't mean to say that he actually breathed fire any more than that verse I read to you a few moments ago about the bottles up in the clouds. This is poetic language describing these animals. And I don't think they would you would write in that kind of language in a zoology book. At least if I had done so in mine, I would have been in trouble. This isn't zoology we're doing. This is poetical language describing the fierceness of these animals. But because poetic language is used of them, it doesn't mean to say they're mythological. That doesn't prove that they're mythological. It's poetic language. And however they are taken, will you please notice in chapter 40 and verse 15, God says, behold now Behemoth, which I made with thee. He eateth grass as an ox. They're both creatures made by God, according to the book of Job. So therefore I believe they are real, whatever they are. But what about Leviathan? Canst thou draw out verse 1, chapter 41, Leviathan with a hook? Is this a great whale? I don't know. But certainly a great animal, or a great beast out there in the sea. Or his tongue with a cord, which thou lettest down. Canst thou put a hook in his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Will thou take him for a servant forever? Wilt thou play with him as with a bird? Or wilt thou bind him for thy maidens? Shall the companions make a banquet for him? Shall they part him among the merchants? Canst thou fill his skin with barbed irons, or his head with fish spears? Lay thy hand upon him and remember the battle and do no more. Behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? None is so fierce that dare stir him up. Or who then is able to stand before me? Who hath prevented me that I should repay him? Whatsoever is under the whole heaven is mine. I'll not conceal his parts, nor his power, nor his comely proportion. Who can discover the face of his garment? Or who can come to him with his double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. His scales are his pride. Shut up together as with a close seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together. They cannot be sundered. By his knees a light doth shine, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning, and out of his mouth go burning lamps, and sparks of fire leap out, and out of his nostrils goeth smoke, as out of a seething pot or a cauldron, and his breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. Don't worry, you'll get home safely tonight. And in his neck remaineth strength, and sorrow is turned into joy before him. The flakes of his flesh are joined together. They are firm in themselves, they cannot be moved, and his heart is as firm as stone. Yea, as hard as a piece of nether millstone. When he raiseth up himself, the mighty are afraid. By reason of breakings they purify themselves. The sword of him that layeth at him cannot hold. The spear, the dart, the harbingen. He esteemeth iron as straw, and brass as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned with him into stubble. Darts are counted as stubble. He laugheth at the shaking of a spear. Sharp stones are under him. He spreadeth sharp pointed things upon the mire. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh a path to shine after him. One would think the deep to be hoary. Upon earth there is not his like. Who is made without fear, he beholdeth all high things. He is king over all the children of pride. Leviathan. Now there was in the past a seven-headed dragon in Canaanite mythology who was called Leviathan. And there's no question that that is the kind of word that's used here, and we get that from ancient literature. But that doesn't mean because he's called Leviathan that he has to be a mythological character. You can't prove that. The picture, actually, of chapter 41 fits the crocodile very well enough, or any ones I've ever seen anyway. But other identifications have been proposed by many people, and there are some who really settle for the wheel described here. You say, yes, Derek, okay, we've had two huge animals, we've had all these beautiful creatures, but come on, what's the spiritual truth? Could you listen very quietly to me for 10 minutes? Because I want to quietly read something to you that I have got great help from. I want you to listen very carefully. Because in this, there will be truth that I think you'll be blessed by. Will you please notice that these two speeches are addressed to Job? They are a response to a request in the 30th chapter. What did Job say? Job said, "Oh, that one would hear me. My desire is that the Almighty would answer me, and that mine adversary had written a book. I want God to write a book and to answer me." Well, here it is. But you say the speeches are not what Job asked for, as far as their content is concerned. You say to me, he has requested God to give him either a bill of indictment or to charge him with specific charges that he's done wrong, and then he'll answer God. Or please, a verdict from his judge that he can confidently expect to be declared innocent. But nothing about that here. Nothing of that forthcoming. And these are very lengthy recitals, and they're not replies to the questions that have tormented Job, which his friends have failed to answer, are they? At least on the first inspection, they're not. And they don't seem to have anything to do with the central issue of why Job has suffered so severely when he has done everything humanly possible to maintain a good relationship with God. God answers Job's questions with a deluge of counter questions. But the function of these questions need to be very properly understood. They're a rhetorical device, as a preacher would use or a teacher would use, and a question can be another way of making a pronouncement. As God asks these questions, he is making a pronouncement. And these questions are invitations and suggestions about discoveries that he will make as he tries to find his own answers. You know, it's not like a catechism. You know, you learn a catechism and then, ask questions. It's not like a catechism, as if Job's knowledge is being tested. Do you know about the eagle? Do you know about this and that and the other? No, these questions of God in these lovely chapters are educating him in the true and original meaning of what true education is. Job is being led out from his circumstances out into where? Wait for it. The world around him. That's where he's being led. And the questions are rhetorical only in the sense that none of them has any answer ventured by Job. But this is not because the questions have no answers, because Job doesn't answer them. The initial effect of these questions is to drive home to Job his ignorance. But these questions are not intended to humiliate him. On the contrary, he has been given the highest nobility any person could ever have. He's just been enrolled in God's school. In the school of God's wisdom. And the schoolroom that Job is in is the world around him. And God's teaching him. And for Job, the exciting discoveries to which God leads him brings a big giant advance in knowledge of himself and of God. God helps him to know himself better and him, and God better. And that's what the Bible always does. It teaches you more about yourself and more about God. Now, the very fact in these lovely chapters that God doesn't come forward as the friends did with a big long list of Job's sins is sufficient proof that that wasn't needed. That God speaks at all to Job is enough for Job before this book's through. All he needs to know is that everything is right between himself and God. And knowing that, he doesn't care what happens to him. As we shall see next week. And to that extent, it doesn't really matter all that much what to talk about. Although, there are great teachings here. Any topic will do for a satisfying conversation between friends. I've got a dear friend and I go to see him often. And we sit down together and we talk about the most ridiculous things. But I love him in the Lord and I hope he loves me. And there we sit and we talk about cornflakes and dolly mixtures. If you like. Ah, but it's good because he's my friend. And I like to hear him talk. And hear God and Job are talking about everyday things. It is the fact that God's talking to him. That's thrilling Job. But this doesn't mean that the content of the Lord's speeches is irrelevant. But they are a very subtle route to lead Job to complete satisfaction. Oh, I know that some people have scorned these answers. They say there's nothing about God's moral government of human affairs and his dealings with man. And they seem to sidestep the issues which have dominated the book up to this point. There's no reference to Job's experience. That's true. There's no reference to his problems. That's true. There's no debate with any of the things that Job and the other speakers have said. That's true. And the obvious resolution to tell Job at long last what was really behind it all and to disclose to Job the fact that doubt has been cast on his character by Satan, and that the Lord has been all the time confidently putting Job to the test, is never revealed to Job. I say, why didn't God come out and tell him that he was being used as a battleground, and that Satan had said, take this all away from him, and take all these things that you've given to him a blessing away from him, and he'll curse you to your face? Job never knew that Satan had said that on earth. Never! Up until the moment of his death, he never knew what had happened. And can I say in God's presence tonight, it is one of the many excellences of the book of Job that Job is brought to contentment without ever knowing the facts of his case. Oh, brother and sister, you don't know the facts of your case, do you, as God knows them? You wish you did! You cry like Job did, Lord, answer me, answer me, answer me. Ah, but God is going to bring you to complete contentment without knowing all the facts of what's happening to you. You'll not know it all until you see his face. And then you'll know, even as you are known. And in view of the way in which Satan brought up the matter, something had to be done to rescue Job from his slander? Yes. And the test would work only if Job didn't know what it was for. So he never knew. And God thrust Job into an experience of dereliction to make it possible for Job to enter into a life of naked faith and to learn to love God for himself alone and not for all the blessings he gives. And to withhold the full story from Job, even after the test was over, keeps him walking by faith and not by sight. God holds facts back from you, Christian. And you prayed and prayed to get an answer, but they haven't come. And God holds it back. And he shelters you from the future and shelters me from the future. Why? Because he wants you and I to walk by faith and not by sight. We are men and women of faith. We are trusting and following a God we've never seen. Thomas said, I'd love to put my hand into the side, Lord. I'd love to touch your wounds. I'd love to touch your side. I won't believe it, he said to the disciples, unless I touch those wounds. And Jesus appeared to him one day. He said, come on, Thomas, touch me. And he fell on his knees, on his face, and he said, my Lord and my God. And Jesus said, blessed are they that have not seen and yet believe. We've never seen him, but we believe. With all our hearts, we believe. We walk by faith and not by sight. And the reasons why those problems haven't all been answered and your questions haven't all been answered is very simple, yet profound. God wants you to walk by faith and to trust him even though you don't have the answers. And he does not say in the end, oh, I see it all now, Lord. Terrific, thanks very much. I see it all now. No. Will you notice chapter 42, verse 5, Job says, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent on dust and ashes. More of that next week, but what he's saying is, I'm not saying to you, Lord, now I see it all. He's saying, Lord, now I see you. Will you please note that George Bernard Shaw was up the wrong road altogether when in his book, The Adventures of the Black Girl in Her Search for God in 1930-something, he makes that character in that story say, or that play, he says, the Lord's speech is a sneer. It's not a sneer. Didn't God invite Job to stand up like a man? And God never hints that it is not for us to question the Almighty and say, you shouldn't be asking questions about me, Job, you keep quiet. No, he allows us to ask questions. And I can tell you something, and I have learned this from my heart. Part of our innovation is caused by a long-standing tradition in Western Christian thought that belittles the knowledge of God gained by thinking about our world. Now, Wordsworth was a pantheist and said that nature is God. The mountains, the trees, the birds, all the rest of it, that's God. That's not what the Bible teaches. But when we stand against pantheism, don't please let it rob us of being able to know God through the world around us. I was saying to the Lord when I was driving down here tonight, if I say to these folk tonight, Lord, what's in my mind, maybe they'll drum me out of the place. But you know, the summary of all this tremendous teaching is, go take a walk in the park. Go out in the back garden and sit down for 10 minutes and look around you. Go for a wee walk some night and have a look at the stars. Go on. Get out there and look at it. And learn that the God who cares for that wild ox and that wild ass and the eagle and the little ones being born in obscurity and the God who can handle the whale and the crocodile and the world that he has made cares for you. And there's not a sparrow falls to the ground but that he knows about it. You say, well, Derek, if I had known that, I wouldn't have had to come to all this series. I'd have just gone for a walk. No, the word is saying more to you than that. God needs to take you around the garden. You need to go for a wee walk in the park with the Lord. Let him conduct you around his world, as he did with Job. God enjoys his world, and he wants you to enjoy it with him. But it's only God can conduct a profitable excursion. No, the aim's not to crush Job. Mere fact that God conversed with him gave him a dignity above the birds and the beasts. assuring him that it's a splendid thing to be a man, and to look at any bird and flower as a revelation of God and his constant care for the world. And here before us tonight, before we leave, is proof that a man can love God simply for being God. Say hallelujah. Hallelujah. Not for the reward. That's where Job comes to. He hasn't answered all my questions. He's not worried about that. He's touched God. He's known God. He's heard God. And there's many a believer listening to me tonight has heard God's voice and met him in the person of the Lord Jesus. And you can bear God's silences when you've heard him speak. I tell you, you can. Here is a proof that he's not in it for the reward. And here the lack of a formal answer to the moral question by the narrowing of the spotlight onto one individual is instructive. And Job is vindicated in the faith in God's goodness that has survived the terrible deprivation and grown despite it, unsupported by constitutions, by revealed knowledge, by preachers, by prophets, by kindly friends, unsupported by traditions, and contradicted by his experience. Alone he has found God in his life. And Job's faith is not exercised blindly in a vacuum. It's exercised in the world. And I love it. All these poems about goats and ostriches are not a tangent to the rest of the book. It's a man in the world that Job stands before God. And he's not called to a flight of pure thought, to a transcendent beyond. He's not called to plunge into the depths of himself to find the ground of it all. It's by looking at the wee ordinary common things seemingly around him that Job is able to exclaim in the end, I'm satisfied. I've seen you with my own eyes. And this is more than enough to answer all his questions. Or rather, it liberates him to live with joy, even though the questions aren't answered. Shall we pray?